The organization known as the Knights of the Black Circle was created for the same reasons any youth gang forms. For protection from other gangs and a sense of belonging for those who didn't belong anywhere else. Like many gangs do, the organization started purely defensively, but whether or not the gang ever moved to the offense and became its own source of problems is speculated only in rumors. The Knights were formed at the end of the 70s in the village of Northport, New York. They were made up of mostly teenage hippies who just wanted a little protection over their weed-selling business. Even though they lived in a relatively small village, the village was on the north shore of Long Island, so other villages, towns, and even New York City itself all bled together relatively close by. Even just a few kids selling joints to friends and family brought the attention of larger and much more dangerous organizations. The Knights first formed in a place called Cow Harbor Park, which due to a combination of zoning problems and outdated laws was a place where police were technically not supposed to patrol. The neighboring town of Huntington owned the park, but it was on Northport property, so it fell out of either jurisdiction. Northport police could walk through the park, but any arrests made would bring on a litany of legal problems. Because of that, anyone and everyone who wanted to do or deal drugs went to Cow Harbor Park. On warm days, over 100 people would be there. The park sat along the harbor and had a playground, a gazebo, and a few chess tables. But on the other side of the harbor was a patch of woods. Those who wanted a bit of privacy could go into the woods to smoke or drink, but really, because of the legal headache that would have come with arresting anyone, many teenagers and adults alike opted to smoke weed or drop acid in plain view of anyone walking by. The teenagers who would eventually form the Knights had their home base just a bit into the woods at an old round table where they would roll their joints. Sometimes police would walk through the park just to remind everyone they could, and the Knights would cover their work with guitar cases, pretending to just be playing music. But really, they didn't even need to do that much. Sometimes the cops were coming to the park to buy weed themselves. The Knights got their name from the round table they worked at because it reminded one boy, Paul McBride, of the round table from Arthurian legends. The members became either knights or kings, depending on their ranks. They decided to formalize their organization because they were getting beaten up and jumped, and their product was getting stolen by other gangs coming into the city. They started only traveling in groups, as well as brainstorming ways to strike fear into the hearts of their enemies. They took inspiration from the popular rock and metal bands from the time, Black Sabbath, Ozzy Osbourne, AC/DC, and started using imagery of the devil to shock people. They all bought leather jackets, and Paul McBride painted inverted pentagrams on each of them. Each member also got his own unique design of the devil, demons, or other demonic imagery. All of that pageantry was a huge success. Some reports say that at their height, the Knights had over 60 members. The Knights did not go unnoticed in the town. Kids started to tell each other about satanic rituals in the woods that the Knights were supposedly committing. Of course, the Knights staunchly denied that, saying they were only putting on a show. But it was one hell of a show that they were putting on. They carved Hail Satan and 666 into the gazebo at Cow Harbor Park. At one point, someone found a stillborn goat that had been stolen from a nearby farm and partially burned. People whispered about family cats going missing, and one member would eventually admit to throwing cats into bonfires, but they said they would simply run out and that they were just having a laugh. Hilarious. There were rumors that they'd hold masses up at Aztequia Woods, a place that held as much significance for the local youth as Cow Harbor Park. Aztequia Woods was a short walk from the park and not even all that far into the forest. However, because it was on private property, police were hesitant to patrol it and it had the same kind of legal immunity as Cow Harbor Park. The woods had been developed before, but now all that remained were a few cement foundations and crumbling concrete walls. The local kids gave the woods the name because the ruins reminded them of the ancient Aztec temples. There was also a small clearing near the ruins, so kids would hang out and build bonfires or drink without needing to dodge trees if they went at night. Most stories about the ruins in the woods say they belonged to a church of some kind. as Tekkia Woods was where the youth could go to truly get away with anything, and people spread rumors that the knights would hold black masses in the old ruins. One member did later admit that they held masses, but would not say what exactly they entailed. In many ways, the knights represented true LaVeyan Satanism, which is an atheistic philosophy started by Anton LaVey in the 60s. In short, LaVeyan Satanism is just a collection of ideas about how to live one's life in an individualistic but ethical way. The philosophy uses satanic imagery to push back on mainstream Christianity and find one's own path in life. LaVey was also famous for his love of controversy and pageantry, and he dressed his ideas up in rituals and demonic imagery because he found it fun. The knights say they were not worshipping the devil, simply using his image to protect themselves and live their lives. But LaVeyan Satanism is not the only kind out there, and devil worship is and has always been a very real thing. Whether the knights ever actually held black masses or communed with the devil is unknown. But after they all graduated and the organization dissipated, a successor would come along who would bring his own version of Satanism to the town. This is Monsters. Ricky Casso was born on March 29, 1967, placing him firmly in Generation X, which has been nicknamed the Latchkey Generation. That's because of the popularization of free-range parenting styles that many children of that generation grew up in, myself included. Kids would come home to an empty house, curfews were seldom enforced, and boys were taught to solve any problems they had with their fists. Richard Schock, a classmate of Ricky's who would later tell author Jesse P. Pollock, who wrote the book The Acid King, that it was a time when kids who were arguing with each other were sent out to fight and sort their differences. He even recalled teachers occasionally taking bets on who would win. And of Ricky's childhood friends, it's important to note that in a story with so much publicity, the bulk of which has been wrong or exaggerated, many of those involved have declined to give interviews at different points or have asked to have their names changed. The most recent and most comprehensive source on the case is The Acid King, and in the book, some who have previously had their real names published have chosen to withhold their names, while others who were previously interviewed under pseudonyms have since decided to speak under their real names. Because that's the most recent deep dive that has interviewed multiple people directly, this episode will occasionally use pseudonyms for those who gave the bulk of their interviews in that book, as that's how they have most recently elected to be identified. But while some friends were able to escape the spotlight and later media circus and speak out anonymously, Ricky's family was not, and they have been discussed extensively. The most controversial figure in Ricky's life, who's been criticized heavily by friends and family, was his father, Dick Casso. Dick believed that men were men and that a good beating would solve any problems he had with his children. Dick was a coach, and sports were even more important to him than his children. When his wife Lynn went into labor with Ricky, he made her wait until the game he was watching was over before he drove her to the hospital. Growing up, all that Dick cared about really was that his children were athletic. Ricky had three little sisters who all got into different sports as they got older, but as the firstborn son, the pressure was on him to be perfect. Dick didn't know it, but Ricky coped with the pressure and let off steam by doing drugs. He'd started smoking marijuana at the end of elementary school and got into hallucinogens in seventh grade. What exactly Ricky was doing is a bit unclear, but the popular form of hallucinogen at the time was something called purple microdots, which may have contained any combination of acid, PCP, or strychnine. Ricky made the bulk of his friends through either drugs or sports, and his friends who didn't play sports would still show up to baseball or football games to cheer him on or sometimes to tease him when he messed up. Dick showed up to his games too, though. Dick would interrupt games to criticize his son's playing in front of everyone. He would scream at Ricky and sometimes even at the coaches. Friends who were closer and spent time at the Casso family home recalled Dick often sending them home so he could beat his son if he disappointed him in a game. Being younger and girls, Ricky's sisters may not have experienced the same treatment. His two immediate younger sisters, Kelly and Jody, were both popular and obedient and didn't outwardly have a problem with needing to focus on athletics, while the youngest, Wendy, was too young to really have the pressure on yet. Since Kelly and Jody were both close in age, they became best friends, and Ricky became almost a father figure to Wendy, who was 7 years younger than him. He would comfort her when she was sad and go to her events that their father couldn't be bothered with. He coddled her because someone had to. Ricky's middle school years were when things started to go downhill. In seventh grade, Ricky broke into a church to steal the collection money. He also made off with communion wafers. Soon after that, Ricky and a few other friends broke into a family's home while they were on vacation, and the boys were all caught and arrested. Dick didn't really seem upset about the burglary, but when he realized his son was stealing to support a drug habit, he was furious. As middle school ended, Ricky dropped out of all sports completely, and his father resented him for it. He also started dealing acid in large quantities. That's how he eventually earned his nickname, the Acid King. As he entered high school, Ricky's parents decided it was time to get outside help. He was constantly being suspended, and his drug use was becoming more apparent. There was a crisis intervention center known as The Place that specialized in drug abuse, and they tried to set Ricky up with a counselor there. The Place was more than a counseling center, it was a safe space for kids. If they didn't have anywhere to go after school, they could hang out or play board games. Counselors were available on a drop-in basis, which worked very well for kids who struggled to make or keep appointments. But Ricky did not get along at all with the first counselor he met with, and after constantly showing up high and telling his parents they were wasting money, they stopped making him go. Ricky did find guidance and camaraderie in a new friend, though, a boy by the name of James Troiano. James's friends called him either Jimmy, Dracula, or Drac. That was because he had very sharp canines and a prominent scar on his cheek. He'd gotten the scar from an accident on a swing set when he was little, where the metal hook that held the swing ripped open his cheek. Jimmy didn't have many friends. He'd been raised in an orphanage until the age of 4, and he always seemed to have something to prove. He was quick to escalate fights and emotionally volatile. Jimmy and Ricky bonded over their shared love of drugs and petty thievery. Both were having problems at home because of that, and in the winter of 1980, they decided to run away from home together. The Casso family had a vacation home in Argyle, about 4 hours from Northport, and the boys drove up and squatted in the cabin for a while. The police soon caught up with them and brought them home, but it had been an adventure the boys had bonded over, and they were inseparable after that. Both boys started to get into more and more trouble at school and with the law over the next 2 years. Eventually, in their sophomore year, Jimmy dropped out and Ricky was expelled. Because of that, he was either kicked out or ran away. During that time, he would crash with friends or sleep behind a gas station called the Midway, which also served as the town's head shop. After he eventually came home, his parents got him enrolled in another school, but he vanished for 2 weeks when he was supposed to start. That was also around the time when he started becoming enamored with the devil. In early 1983, Ricky's parents decided they needed serious help. In March, they had him involuntarily committed to South Oaks Hospital and Rehabilitation Center. He turned 16 while in the hospital and tried to end his life a few days later by hanging himself with his sweatshirt. He stayed at the facility for 3 months, but managed to run away 5 times before being caught by the police. One girl spotted him at a train station during one of his escapes and tried to talk to him. He told her that he wasn't crazy, somewhat unprompted, and when she gently tried to tell him that maybe he just needed help with drugs, he became irrational and started yelling. He was eventually released from the facility for good because he told the counselors he'd given up his belief in the devil and that he was going to go back to school. They gave him a prescription for lithium and said he was manic depressive. The doctors at the rehab center said Ricky wasn't actually trying to remove himself from the world. He just wanted attention, and Dick and Lynn bought it. He had once before feigned a life-ending process for attention, after all. The only time Lynn ever kicked him out was when he was upset at her for trying to enforce a curfew, and he smeared ketchup along his wrists and told her that she had driven him to carry out the act. But still, had he not been found during his attempt in the hospital, he very well could have died. One friend recalled trying to warn Ricky the drugs would kill him, and he replied with, quote, "Yeah, that's exactly what I want." The most tenacious positive force in Ricky's life at the time was a man named Tony Ruggie, who worked at the place. Tony wore his hair long and would play guitar at Cow Harbor Park, so even the most rebellious kids still trusted him. Tony even talked to Jimmy a bit too, so Ricky felt he could trust him. Tony later recalled that Jimmy seemed to have trouble telling right from wrong. In April of 1983, Jimmy was arrested for trespassing, then in quick succession, three more times for burglary in the following months. Eventually, he was sentenced to 5 years of probation and largely stopped trying to get help. Tony still had time to get through to Ricky, though. In early 1983, Ricky went to the place almost every day to talk to Tony. He soon met another counselor named Susie Strakoff, who he also trusted. Tony later said he felt there was a possibility Ricky looked up to him and Susie as a surrogate mother and father. He started showing up to tell them about good things too, hoping for their approval. For a time, Ricky found a special education school that suited him well, but soon he got kicked out for truancy. Dick tried to get him enrolled in another school, but told him he needed to clean up his act and cut his hair. He chased him through the house with scissors, and when Ricky escaped, Dick started cutting up Ricky's clothes on the front lawn. Ricky and Jimmy, still legally children at 16 and 17, got an apartment together rather than return home, and things were somewhat stable. But Jimmy was soon arrested for violating parole, so Ricky lost the apartment. Jimmy spent a year in jail, and Ricky spent much of that time homeless. Harry Shock had been Ricky's Little League coach when he was a kid, and his house backed up to the woods. One day, he found Ricky sleeping in a hole in the ground under the roots of a fallen tree in his yard. He took Ricky in and gave him new clothes and food. When he tried to call Dick to tell him he found Ricky sleeping in the woods, Dick told him to, quote, "mind his own fucking business." Harry's son, Richard, was around Rick's age, and he recalled his parents being a bit wary of him. Sometimes Ricky would show up drugged out and saying the trees were trying to talk to him. On those nights, Harry would stay up while Ricky slept, mindful of the possible danger of letting a drugged out teen he didn't really know stay in his house. Ricky didn't want to overstay his welcome, so he left after a week or so, but would sometimes go back to sleep in the hole in their yard. One time, Dick tracked him there and beat him up in their backyard. Ricky didn't know it, but his friend and classmate Gary Lowers, who would also end up homeless, would frequent many of the same spots as him. The two grew closer together that year as Gary had gotten into acid, and, well, Ricky was the acid king. Gary Lowers and Ricky Casso would eventually become inseparable names in history, and though they might not have known it, the two had a lot in common. Gary also had strict parents, but nothing like Dick. Much of what we know about Gary's childhood comes from interviews with his best friend, Johnny Hayward. Gary met Johnny at Lace's roller rink, and they initially bonded over both being excellent roller skaters. Gary was short and got picked on often, so Johnny became his protector. Just like Ricky and Jimmy, Gary and Johnny were getting into petty crime as they entered high school, but they weren't as efficient. Gary and Johnny would wander onto boats during the off-season and drink the liquor, or they'd steal car stereos to exchange for drugs. They were more small-time and just looking for something to do. But after school let out in 1983, Gary started to come into his own as a criminal. In the summer of 1983, if one had to guess who would become catastrophically violent between Ricky and Gary, one might have guessed Gary. Ricky spent that summer detoxing on a family trip upstate, while Gary spent the summer finally getting into trouble with the law. Seemingly at random, he targeted his friend Mike Muxey. One day, Gary held Mike down and burned him almost a dozen times with a smoking bowl, heating it with a lighter each time. He then stole Mike's BB gun and went around Cow Harbor Park threatening younger kids or pretending to be a cop. Gary was soon caught and he was given 6 years probation for threatening the children, impersonating an officer, and assaulting his friend. That summer, Gary and his friends made a tape of them tripping in the woods. At one point, he said, quote, "I dedicate this tape to the man who invented acid and mescaline. Thanks a lot, man, wherever you are. Fuck the world." When Ricky came back from his trip, he went back to his old ways, doing acid, smoking weed, and stealing. When winter rolled around, he was homeless once again. For a while, Ricky dragged a couch out to Aztekia Woods and lived there. Eventually, he got sick from a bronchial infection. He went to Harry Shock's house again to sleep in the woods, and when Harry spotted him, he brought him inside. He called Dick the next day and yelled at him, telling him Ricky needed to go to the hospital. Dick screamed back and hung up. Ricky thanked the Shock family and left to go to the place. Ricky and Tony worked together to make a plan for the future. He wanted to go back to school and get a job, maybe even a girlfriend. Tony talked Ricky's family into taking him back. When Ricky got home, he cut his hair and his parents brought him to the hospital. He got into yet another school for troubled teens and attended for a while until he left early one day and got suspended. He wasn't expelled, but when he and Dick got into a fight, he left home and stopped going to school. With Jimmy still in jail, Ricky was making new friends. He soon found someone who shared in his love of the occult, and for a while his new best pal was an eccentric drifter who hung out at Cow Harbor Park named Pat Toussaint. He was obsessed with the occult and liked to befriend the local teenagers, who called him either Pagan Pat or Father Time. He was an alcoholic Vietnam veteran who would regularly trade his prescription pills for drugs or booze. He and Ricky would read passages of the Satanic Bible together and felt inspired to spread the good word. One day, Pat and Ricky went to a church and started yelling about Satan to the people leaving Mass. Ricky started getting up to his own satanic antics and told his friends that he was sacrificing animals to the devil, though the most anyone would ever confirm of that was his friend Lori Walsh, who said he was throwing cats in the harbor to watch them thrash around, but they always swam out. When he was high, he would run around town screaming, "I am Satan." Sometimes he would walk around town either chanting or speaking in Latin. When Ricky was around 16 years old, he walked into Cow Harbor Park one day with a cheap but flashy knife he'd bought at the Midway gas station. The graffiti from the knights had since been painted over, so Ricky wanted to bring the spirit of the devil back into the park. He sat in the gazebo and carved the word Satin, S-A-T-I-N, into one of the pillars. He wasn't trying to be funny, he simply didn't know how to spell. That moment encapsulates so much about Ricky Casso. He was desperate to make his mark on the world. He was destructive, but aimless, and though he dearly loved the devil, he didn't actually know much about him, or even why he wanted to worship him. Pat and Ricky soon hatched a plan that they roped Gary and a few other boys into. They were going to rob a grave and steal a skull. Richard Shock later said, quote, "Their plan was to dig this skull up, and that would get Ricky and Father Time in touch with their main man, Satan. They would then go to the Amityville Horror House and invoke Satan and demons by reading incarnations on the lawn." The boys were also feeling inspired to rob a grave so they could one-up their classmate, Randy Guthler, who'd successfully robbed a grave back in October. He'd brought a skull and hand to school to show off to friends in his locker before eventually leaving the bones in and around someone's mailbox as a prank. Ricky figured if one of his classmates had already done it, it couldn't be too hard. He was also not thinking very straight at that time. It was only a few months after his bronchial infection, and by then he had a full case of pneumonia, not to mention all the acid he took, so their plan was not very well thought out. In early spring, Gary, Ricky, and a few friends went to an old cemetery in the woods and started digging. Ricky and his friends dug about 5 feet into the grave before people walking around nearby scared them off, but they were caught right away. When Ricky was arrested, he had on him his pentagram necklace, a list of the hierarchy of demons in hell, and a list of Latin names for the devil. He also carried a picture of Satan in his wallet. Like a wallet-sized headshot, or... The police who interviewed Ricky said it seemed almost like he was looking to shock or impress them. He tried to scare them and say he needed the bones for satanic rituals, but he just seemed unstable and visibly sick. They later remarked they felt sorry for him. The investigation into Ricky's botched grave robbing attempt led police to finally solve Randy's successful attempt, and he got into legal trouble as well. The Northport police were not shy about talking to the media, so that quickly became a bit of a sensation, with cops directly telling the news they were having problems with multiple kids stealing bodies for satanic rituals. Ricky went home after his arrest, needing medical attention once again. His parents brought him to the hospital and tried to ask the doctors to have him committed once they treated his pneumonia, but the doctors evaluated him and didn't think that was necessary. He even told the psychiatrists that if he went to jail for the grave digging, he would make another attempt on his own life. But because he seemed in charge of his faculties and was not hallucinating, he was released. Ricky talked with the media a bit about the grave robbing, but downplayed the satanic element, and the story fizzled. But he was still upset that he didn't have a skull yet. Richard Schock recalled Ricky coming up to him around that time and casually remarking that he was trying to acquire a human skull. He asked Richard if he knew how to get one, and Richard responded in the way anyone who was not Ricky Casso would respond. Quote, "How the fuck would I know where to get a skull, Ricky?" On April 30th, Ricky and Pat went to the Amityville house anyway. They stood on the front lawn, yelling for Satan for a bit, but residents near the house were used to stranger tourists and let them have their fun. Eventually, they gave up and went home. Each time he was homeless, Ricky had fewer and fewer places to stay. He'd been harassing an elderly neighbor of the Shock, so he wasn't welcome back there. For a while, Ricky stayed with Peg and Pat, who was squatting in a houseboat. They had some kind of falling out, though, and Ricky beat Pat bloody in the park one day. As to be expected with an older man who seems to hang out exclusively with children, the rumor mill speculated that Peg and Pat had made a move on Ricky, but that was never confirmed by anyone. Jimmy got out of jail around the same time as the grave robbing scandal, so even though Ricky did not have many places to go, he had a bit of spending money again. Jimmy had strengthened their network in jail, and at one point they had so much money they rented a limo to take them into the Bronx to pick up their supply. But Ricky started keeping a bunch of the drugs for himself, opting to get high rather than sell. He would sleep in all the same spots the other homeless teens would frequent. There was an old abandoned sawmill or Aztekia Woods. One of the better places to crash was in the clubhouse in the backyard of his friend Corey Quinn. Well, really, she became his friend after he was already sleeping there. A girlfriend who felt sorry for Ricky had told him where it was so he could have a place to sleep. It was just an old chicken coop with a couch, but it offered shelter from the elements. When Corey found him, she felt sorry for him and the two became friends. She also let Gary stay there for a bit, so taking care of wayward teens was nothing new. Though she was only 14, she took it upon herself to take care of Ricky. She would sneak him food and stay up late talking to him. She recalled him being very sweet, but in clear need of help. Matthew Carpenter was another friend who tried to help Ricky and let him crash on his couch. Ricky repaid him with scabies and rants about the devil, but Matthew wasn't ready to give up on him. Matthew had been into drugs too and dropped out like Ricky, but he had gotten a decent job and turned his life around. He wanted the same for his friend. While Ricky was deteriorating, Gary was honing his skills at stealing. Gary was not the best at planning for the future. He'd steal money and drugs from friends, but paradoxically then give away money and drugs to other friends, sometimes the ones he'd just stolen from. After a house robbery earned him over $4,000, worth over $12,000 in today's money, he went on a spree. He bought a motorbike for himself and two other friends. He gave a kid he barely knew $500 and told him to, quote, have fun tonight. He gave out acid like candy to friends. He brought $1,000 to the Laces roller rink and threw the money up in the air for everyone to grab. After Ricky got out of the hospital, he was rapidly deteriorating mentally. Between May and early June, he'd lost 40 pounds. His court date for grave robbing was approaching, and he was telling anyone who would listen that if he went to jail, he'd hang himself. He started to grow closer to the devil. Ricky told friends that he could speak to the devil up in Aztekia Woods when he took enough acid. He claimed the devil would show up as a glowing tree. Ricky had been upping his drug use continually over the years, and at that point he would take 10 hits of mescaline a night, or a half dozen tabs of acid, sometimes a combination of the two. He hit the PCP just as hard. Ricky's friends and family tried to reach out. Corey tried to question Ricky about his devil worship one day, but he didn't even seem to understand why he wanted to worship the devil. Ricky's little sister, Wendy, snuck him inside once to take a shower and grab a blanket to keep him warm in the woods, and she tried to give him what little money she had from her allowance, but he wouldn't take it. Ricky showed up at Cow Harbor Park one day swinging around a baseball bat, hitting the playground and mumbling crazily that he was going to kill someone. However, when his friend told him that he was scaring her, he snapped out of it. But it didn't last long. He spent the rest of that week walking around town mumbling to himself. He stayed in Corey's clubhouse the night before his court appearance on June 16th. When Ricky called his parents that morning to ask for a ride, he was slurring his words. Lynn tried to ask him if he was on drugs, and he said he just hadn't been sleeping. He was covered in dirt and hadn't showered in quite some time, but they didn't let him into the house to clean up or eat anything. Dick drove him to the courthouse, but it was uneventful, just a continuation hearing. On the way home, Ricky asked his father for a quarter to get a bagel at the Midway, but his father said no, so he kicked his car door. Dick then kicked him out of the car. Eventually, he came back and gave Ricky $2, but he told him never to speak to their family again. He told his son that he was done with him. In later articles, Dick would lament that he'd tried desperately to help his son. Dick told the New York Newsday that he'd tried everything from, quote, putting your arms around him to, quote, good old Marine discipline. Dick also presented a vastly different version of their final falling out. He said that that morning, Ricky asked him for a quarter to buy a bagel, but Dick tried to convince him to come home for a proper meal instead. Ricky then slammed the door on Dick for no reason at all and stormed off. Then Dick came back and gave Ricky $2 to get some food because he felt bad. He made no mention of telling Ricky that his family was done with him. On June 19th, Rich Barton, a younger kid who sometimes tripped on acid with the other boys, was with Ricky and Jimmy at Aztekia Woods. They tried to make a fire, but the ground was too wet. They listened to some music, Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne. Eventually, the boys wandered back to the main part of the park. There, Gary found Ricky and offered him $20 he had owed him, but Ricky said he didn't want his money. There had been a feud between the two about the money. Gary had previously stolen some drugs from Ricky and was working to pay him back, but Ricky said they were all good and even gave him 3 microdots as a show of good faith. Gary wandered into the woods, tripping, and told everyone he was seeing cats all over the place. The boys all hung around the park for a while, and Gary was feeling good. He talked with a girl named Dorothy about his future, how he wanted to get off drugs, after that night, of course, and finally figure out what he wanted to do with his life. Then the two started trying to remember the words to the Sesame Street theme song as they watched the harbor for sharks. As the day wore on, the other kids all mostly cleared out from Cow Harbor Park to go to Randy Guthler's birthday party, but Ricky, Jimmy, Gary, and their friend Albert Quinones all stayed behind. Ricky and Randy were still mad at each other for getting each other caught up in the grave robbing scandal. Matthew Carpenter and Rich Barton stayed behind too, along with a few girls. The boys who weren't already high started to trip. Their friend Albert only took one hit of mescaline at the urging of the other boys. He wasn't as into drugs as they were, though he would later admit to smoking embalming fluid, so he was certainly willing to experiment. The combination of drugs that each boy was on that night is difficult to know for sure. Sometimes what they thought was angel dust was actually acid or vice versa. But either way, Ricky had taken some combination of hallucinogens in huge amounts, and Jimmy was almost up there with him. Albert and Gary were comparatively more sober, but still very high. Eventually, Rich left a trip by himself at home. The boys took more purple microdots and made a vague plan to get donuts, then go up to Aztekia. Ricky also announced that any girls who wanted to get laid should join them. Shockingly, that did not win over the few girls left at the park. Ricky, Gary, Albert, and Jimmy all left together. Matthew lent them his boombox and promised to join them later in the woods. On the walk to get donuts, Gary was telling Ricky how much he appreciated him being his friend and how glad he was they made up. Ricky was messing with Gary a bit and jokingly lunged at him before saying he was just kidding. They got donuts without incident and then departed for the woods. Johnny finished with his family dinner not too much later and retraced the boys' steps, but by the time he realized they were going to Aztecia, it was already very late. Matthew got cold feet as well. He was creeped out at the idea of venturing into the woods alone and decided not to join them either. That night, it was just Gary, Ricky, Albert, and Jimmy up at Aztecia. What transpired next will probably always be somewhat unclear. Three of the four boys involved would all tell different stories from each other and even contradict themselves at different points. When the case would eventually make its way to court, one of the lawyers involved, Eric Neyberg, said, quote, "I humbly and respectfully submit that only God Almighty knows or will ever know what happened that night." When the boys made their way up to Aztecia, they wanted to get a fire going, but the wood was still wet. Gary donated his socks to use as kindling, and in the middle of the old walls, the boys were finally able to get a small blaze. They would always make fires between the walls of the ruins, because even though they were in the woods, they weren't so isolated that a fire couldn't be seen from nearby houses. There was a small clearing around Aztecia that also made it an ideal place to trip because the trees were thinner and they could move around easier and see the stars. Ricky wanted more from Gary to get the fire going. He told him to burn his jacket. Gary compromised by cutting off the sleeves and saying he had a new vest. With that addition, the fire was going more steadily. Jimmy said that he watched the trees melt together and the stars race overhead, and then Gary laid down and said he had a funny feeling they were going to beat him up. Ricky claimed that he'd told Albert and Jimmy that he was going to kill Gary that night. Jimmy agreed that Albert knew, but Albert denied it. Gary and Ricky soon agreed to fight one-on-one and settle things once and for all. The boys started fighting, and at first it seemed like any other squabble. Albert later said Gary was winning until Jimmy came over and kicked Gary in the ribs. Albert and Ricky both agreed that when the fight started to escalate, Jimmy told Ricky to slit Gary's throat. Ricky bit Gary on the neck and with no warning pulled out his knife and stabbed Gary in the side. Albert said the whole thing was like a nightmare and he was frozen in shock. While Ricky was stabbing Gary, the trees reached down and tried to grab him. He said, quote, "I was just tripping out, man. I was peeking." Jimmy said he jumped in after Ricky had already stabbed Gary once, which is when he kicked him in the ribs. He said, quote, "I know I broke some ribs because I felt that side cave in." Gary called out, quote, "I love you, Mom," before managing to get away from his attackers. Albert said that Gary asked him to help as he ran away, saying, quote, "Al, stop them. Don't let them kill me." When Gary got away and Ricky chased him, Albert did run after them, intending to trip Ricky and let Gary get away. But Ricky caught Gary before Albert could catch up. Jimmy later recalled catching Gary or holding him down, but Albert says Ricky caught him on his own. They all agreed, though, that when Ricky dropped his knife, Jimmy picked it back up and handed it to him. With Gary back near the fire, Jimmy and Ricky took turns cutting off bits of his hair and throwing it into the blaze. Ricky made Gary get on his knees and say, quote, "I love Satan," and he said he heard a crow caw right as Gary said it. Sure he did. Ricky said that that was the devil's sign that he was doing the right thing. Jimmy would later admit to holding Gary down when Ricky started stabbing him in the back and side again, but Albert and Ricky disagree about that. However, Albert also recalled a swarm of bees showing up during the attack. Don't do drugs, kids. The point is, none of them likely know what actually happened. Either way, Jimmy didn't seem to care about his involvement. Jimmy later said he knew Gary needed to die so he wouldn't rat them out, and didn't seem upset when he recounted as much to the police. Jimmy was emotionless when he later described Ricky stabbing Gary over and over while he begged for his life. When Gary eventually collapsed, Ricky stood over him and started talking about the devil. Jimmy and Ricky started dragging him into the woods, but Gary sat back up and Ricky freaked out and stabbed him in the face over and over again. Some reports say he intentionally gouged out his eyes, but the boys mostly seem to agree that it was more just that Ricky was stabbing his entire face. Albert said that after Gary was dead, Ricky and Jimmy stood over his body and said they could see smoke coming out of his back. Gary was stabbed 36 times altogether. Albert helped drag his body to the woods and would eventually admit to kicking Gary in the face during the initial fight. They covered his body with leaves and left the scene. Albert later said that the only reason he thinks Jimmy and Ricky didn't kill him too was because he was the only one who wasn't homeless and they needed to go to his house to wash off Gary's blood. The next day, Albert told Ricky to throw the knife in the harbor. Ricky went to Corey's clubhouse that night for the last time because shortly afterwards, Corey's father tore it down when he realized she'd been letting wayward boys stay there. Jimmy and Ricky both told each other to keep quiet, but neither one did. Over the next 2 weeks, they told more than a dozen of their friends about the murder. Granted, some of them thought they were joking. Jimmy had told his girlfriend Karen, and she simply laughed it off, but her friend Lori Walsh was also there during the confession. Interestingly, Ricky never told Corey or Matthew Carpenter what happened, though he saw them both frequently. Ricky's behavior after the murder was bizarre and contradictory. He would waffle between telling people he was quitting acid and that knives were dangerous and bragging openly about being a killer. It took a while for anyone out of the loop to start to wonder about Gary because he was homeless on and off and he would disappear often. Someone even called Gary's mother to tell her that they'd killed her son and now she would never see him again, and she assumed it was a prank. One day, Ricky confessed to Rich Barton. Rich didn't believe him because half of the time Ricky was hallucinating. Nonetheless, he humored him and went up to Aztekia. When he saw Gary's body, he left, but didn't call the police. Rich was only 14 and Jimmy and Ricky were 18 and 17. He told the New York Newsday, quote, "I was just so scared. I thought that one night I'd be sleeping in my room and Ricky would just pop up there and kill me." Rich still let Ricky sleep on his couch or on his floor because he was afraid to tell him no. Ricky eventually tried to convince Rich to help him bury Gary, but Rich refused. David Breskin, a reporter for the Rolling Stone, would eventually do a deep dive on the case, and when he asked why no one went to the police, he got a lot of the same answers from other kids. They were scared and they didn't know what to do. One girl said Jimmy told her boyfriend a week after it happened that he was laughing and seemed delighted in recounting every detail. Albert said he didn't know what to do because he thought if he went to the police, Jimmy and Ricky would conspire to frame him. He was afraid of them too. He said they would laugh about the murder and joke about how they should find someone else to kill or, quote, go up there and watch him rot. Albert started having nightmares because of the guilt. In one, he even killed Gary himself. He was also getting acid flashbacks about the murder, so some of his nightmares were waking hallucinations. He said that he once heard Gary's screams in his house late at night, and that another time he saw a skeleton floating in his room that he thought was Gary haunting him. A local couple were also let in on the secret. They drove Ricky to the woods with a shovel at his request, but didn't believe he'd actually killed anyone. Jimmy joined them at the scene, and when the boys showed them Gary's corpse, the couple were horrified. Jimmy told them that, quote, "Gary's in hell now because we made him say he loved Satan." The horrified couple left without helping to bury the body. Ricky and Jimmy then dug a shallow grave and rolled Gary's body in, but his head fell off because he was so decomposed. Ricky then kicked it into the grave. The boys knew that Aztekia Woods was slated for development at some point and worried they would be caught. They toyed with burning down the woods, but eventually settled on running away to California or maybe enlisting in the army. While they were plotting, someone finally decided to come forward. It was Lori Walsh who finally decided to call the police. She'd been trying to see if the whole thing might have been a joke, so she'd been asking around about Gary. But neither his mother nor any of his friends had heard from him, so she finally placed an anonymous 911 call. Because Lori didn't give her name and there was no one missing as far as police knew, they didn't bring in extra resources for the search and it took a few days. There were also storms the first few days of July, which would have made it difficult for cadaver dogs to work anyway. While that was happening, Ricky and Jimmy were going on a road trip upstate. They wanted to find a car not tied to either of them to make the trip to California. They visited an old friend named Tony Mallory, who lived near the Casso family summer home. They were honest with Tony about why they were there and confessed to killing Gary. When Ricky first started describing the crime to Tony, he tried to say he'd been so high on mescaline that he didn't even remember doing it until a friend took him back to see the body later. But as the night wore on, he forgot about his ruse and started describing the murder to Tony in graphic detail. Tony helped them anyway, and the next day arranged for them to buy a cheap car for $50. They then went back to Northport to sell off their stash and get enough money to drive across the country. They were upstate until Wednesday, coming back just in time for police to find Gary's body on July 4th. Police initially thought whoever killed him had decapitated him and were hell-bent on finding those responsible. Thanks to Lori, they knew to go after Ricky, Jimmy, and Albert, but they knew Ricky and Jimmy were homeless and at times hard to find, so they decided to go after Albert first. They were planning on seeing if Albert was at his house before making a move, so that if he wasn't home, his family and friends couldn't warn him. Three detectives took an unmarked car and dressed in plain clothes. It was Gene Romer, Jim McCready, and Tommy Schramm. They parked the car a few blocks away from Albert's house, and Schramm jumped out, while the other two kept driving. He was planning on meeting up with them down the road. When he snuck up to the home, he was able to look into the living room, but he wasn't very subtle. Albert's little sister, also named Wendy, and her friend Mark were both hanging out on the couch and spotted the officer right away. They ran outside to catch Schramm, thinking he was a peeping Tom, but he was gone. The other two officers in the car heard someone call 911 about a prowler nearby, and they realized Schramm had been spotted. The kids were chasing the officer down the street, but his fellow officers found him before he got caught. They took Schramm back to the station and came up with a plan that they all found rather funny. Schramm changed back into his uniform and took a police car out, while the other two followed him still undercover. Officer Schramm drove back and made a big show of slowly driving around the house with spotlights, so Wendy, Mark, and Albert went out to talk to him. Schramm questioned them about the prowler, even going so far as to quiz them about what he looked like. He asked the trio to get in the back of his car and help him look, and they agreed. Wendy soon saw the other two officers hiding behind a parked car, and Schramm put on a show of asking Albert to be his backup in case things got hairy. He then drove Wendy and Mark a ways away to safety. He then pulled up to McCready and Romer and parked next to their car. Even though Schramm already had Albert in the police car, he called the other men on the radio, told them, quote, "I got him," and the two opened the car and dragged Albert out, putting him in the unmarked car. They then took him to the station, where they questioned him for a few hours, but he refused to talk, so they released him. Albert says they kept him there for hours and tried to beat him into talking. They didn't say they were also looking for Ricky and Jimmy, and Albert was afraid if he confessed he would go down for the murder, so he told them nothing and they eventually gave up. Mark recalled Albert coming home bloodied and bruised later that night. The next day, authorities got a call about a suspicious car. It was the one Ricky and Jimmy had bought upstate, and they'd parked it in a random spot in a neighborhood to sleep. Police surrounded the car, but the two were passed out and didn't wake up until officers knocked on the door. When they got back to the station, they brought Albert back in and had him pass Jimmy in the hallway. Perhaps because he saw Albert had already been beaten, or perhaps because he was ready to give up, Jimmy yelled at Albert to just tell them everything. Investigators questioned the boys that day and then brought them to an arraignment. Ricky's parents did not attend. The media took pictures of Ricky and Jimmy being led to court, Ricky still wearing a borrowed AC/DC shirt from a friend, and the media went into full-blown satanic panic mode. That night, they placed Jimmy on a special watch to keep him from harming himself, but not Ricky. There was no shortage of people that Ricky had told that he would end his own life if he was caught, either because he did not want to spend time in jail or, as he said to one friend, so he could be the devil's right-hand man in hell. But to the prison psychiatrist, he said he was feeling perfectly fine and they just took him at his word. That night, inmates around Ricky started chanting, "Hang up," and he obliged. He twisted his bedsheet around his neck and made good on the threat that he'd said so many times before. They found his body at 2:17 a.m. One friend said that around the time Ricky died that night, his locked bedroom door mysteriously slammed open. He thought it was Ricky bidding him farewell. Another friend recalled driving close to Aztekia Woods shortly after Ricky died and his headlights blacking out the minute he drove past. Two deaths so close together, one at the hands of another friend, devastated the community. Michelle DeVoe, who had been seeing Gary at the time, was heartbroken. She said that when her parents sat her down and said they had news for her, she immediately assumed one of her friends had died because it had already been happening so frequently. In the last 2 years, three of her friends had passed away. One was killed, one self-inflicted, and one died in a motorcycle crash. The investigation and subsequent media circus ensured a sensational but speedy trial. One officer, Luis Rodriguez, had taken Jimmy's most incriminating statement, but had botched it because he agreed to knowingly omit the fact that Jimmy admitted to picking up the knife during the attack. He would later admit that in court, rendering Jimmy's statement unusable. Due to a miscommunication, the Suffolk County Chief of Detectives, John Gallagher, ended up writing the press release for the case, even though that was something that was meant to be handled by a media liaison and they had a whole team at their disposal. Gallagher made a statement rife with typos and baseless assumptions that would bring the attention of the entire world to Northport. The statement said that it was a fact that Ricky was a member of a satanic cult. It said that Ricky had carved out Gary's eyes at the devil's behest and that there were numerous witnesses who all helped. Various news outlets dug up the grave robbing story and reporters started interviewing the townspeople about the Knights of the Black Circle as well, and soon the papers were in a frenzy. One article made the assumption that Ricky was part of the Knights and that there was still a murderous cult on the loose. If the misinformation wasn't enough, to understand why some people involved have never given interviews, an anecdote described by David Breskin sums up precisely why people don't always talk to the media. David was speaking with some of the local kids at Gary's wake when another reporter walked up to question the kids, but when he spoke to them, he'd forgotten Gary's name at his own funeral. Aside from the media, there was also the threat of physical violence. After David Breskin's article would eventually be released, someone burned down Rich Barton's family home. They escaped unhurt, but it's easy to understand why many people have asked to have their names changed or simply elected never to speak to the media at all. After Gary's funeral, a crowd of teenagers made their way to Cow Harbor Park to clean up graffiti. They erased anything about Satan or in support of Ricky. The trial was slated for the spring of 1985. William Keaton was brought on for the prosecution and Eric Neyberg for the defense. Neyberg had also agreed to represent Jimmy in all of his other pending charges as he was still awaiting judgment on burglary charges. Albert was given immunity in exchange for testifying. In the lead-up to the trial, potential jurors were dismissed by the dozens because of the media circus. Eric Neyberg was going to focus on having Jimmy's confession thrown out because it was made without either his parents or a lawyer present. Thanks to Officer Rodriguez admitting to taking a partially false statement, though, he really didn't have to do all that much. The prosecution was counting on Albert to be their ace in the hole as he'd described Jimmy holding down Gary in a previous statement. But near the end of the trial, Albert came forward to say he'd been lying and telling everyone the statement the police had forced him to say. He eventually told the truth, that he never saw Jimmy directly hold down Gary. He also talked about the police trying to beat him into submission. Neyberg did an excellent job during the trial, but really, he didn't have to. With their star witness switching sides on the stand, there wasn't much the prosecution could do. Jimmy Troiano was acquitted on April 25, 1985. Eric Neyberg left after the trial concluded and went back on his word about representing Jimmy for the other charges. Neyberg told the media, quote, "I've got paying clients. I've done my public service." Though he was found not guilty, Jimmy would spend most of his life up until the present day behind bars. He only got a few years for the robbery charges, but he stayed in a constant cycle of spending a few years on the outside, then a few years inside for various robberies each time he was released. After the death of Gary Lowers, the community did try their best to curb the spread of drugs and give kids more support. Tony Ruggie continued to advocate for more awareness and help for today's youth, and a youth outreach program started helping out the place and supporting the community. After the murders, Huntington agreed to lease Cow Harbor Park to Northport so police could keep an eye on it. Aztekia Woods was finally torn down and paved over with the housing development. By 1985, the media had stopped swarming on Northport, though residents would get the occasional car driving through slowly, with passengers asking about where the devil worshippers were. Eventually, Randy Guthler managed to convince the press he wasn't a devil-worshipping cult member. The Knights of the Black Circle opened up about their organization a bit and helped to further dispel rumors. Albert joined the army and eventually went on to tell his story in a memoir that discussed not only the murder but the rest of his life. His book focused on curbing the spread of misinformation, as the damage done by that initial press release has never fully been erased. Articles for decades after would talk about the satanic cult in Northport and how dozens of devil worshippers conspired to kill Gary together. Gary's old friend Johnny visited Gary's mother Yvonne for over a decade before she asked him to stop, as she was ready to move on. There was never a funeral for Ricky Casso. His parents had been up at their vacation home when he died, and his father treated his death much the same way as his birth, as a nuisance that he would get to when he was less busy. The Cassos took their time coming back into town to get his ashes, though to be fair, that was also to protect their daughters from the media. It was only after Dick eventually died that Lynn scattered her son's ashes in an undisclosed location. Though many people think of Satan as a monster, he's only a fairy tale, but people like Ricky Casso are real. They're your neighbors, your children's friends, the kid riding his bike down your street. They're the monsters you should be watching out for. If you're the victim of domestic abuse, please reach out to someone for help. Please talk to your local shelter or call the National Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can go to thehotline.org to chat with someone online. This website is set up so that, at any time, hitting the escape key twice will take you to a Google search page. That way, if your abuser is nearby, you won't get caught seeking help. If you're having feelings of harming yourself or someone else, or even just need someone to talk to, please contact your local mental health facility. Call 911 or call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline by simply dialing 988 in the United States. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and will talk to you about any mental health issue you may be facing. If you are a member of the LGBTQ+ community and suffering from discrimination, depression, or are in need of any support, please contact the LGBT National Hotline at 1-888-843-4564 or go to lgbthotline.org. Thanks so much for letting me tell you this story. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on whatever platform you're on, hit like, rate us, or leave us a comment. You can check out our other show, Somewhere Sinister, on YouTube or anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, check out our merchandise at thisismonsters.com. The link is in the description. Thanks again, and be safe.